Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
So tell you what, two pieces of advice for the home cinema viewer of advancing years, which I've been reminded of this morning. We recorded this on Sunday morning, aren't we?
Yeah.
And I'm just telling you that I've just been enjoying one of my favourite things to do on Sunday morning, which is watch the rest of a film.
That you fell asleep in the middle of.
Started on Saturday night or whatever's fell asleep or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing like sitting on the sofa, you've had a slice of toast, you've got a cup of tea, you know, it's 8:30 in the morning or whatever. You're not going to fall asleep in the next 10 minutes and you're going to watch the film with all your faculties. That's great fun. So that's a piece of advice one.
It's true. We start at 7 o'clock usually. The movie starts at 7 o'clock. I have a little break for supper. Because if you start about 9 o'clock at night, there's a strong chance you're nudging each other, going, "Who's this bloke? What's happening now?"
Now, this is the second piece of advice, Mark, for the Sunday morning film for your advancing years. Put the subtitles on, regardless of whether the film's supposedly in English or not. Because the way films are mixed nowadays, you simply can't hear what's going on.
There you go.
So I've just been watching Al Pacino and Robert De Niro in Heat. I watched the entire central scene where the two of them have a cup of coffee together in a diner and thoroughly understood it for probably the first time because I was reading the subtitles while listening to them talking. So those are my two pieces of advice.
Could you have got through The Wire without the subtitles?
No, I watched the whole of The Wire with subtitles.
Yeah, we did too.
And then my understanding of it was vastly enhanced by doing that. You know, because they're mumbling actors. And you see, the problem is the director and the writer, they've seen the script. We at home, we haven't.
And we only get one crack at it. Exactly. And it's gone. What?
we're only catching 20% of what's in there. You know, so anyway. Okay, Stat Waddy game. Shall I go?
Go on, go first.
We were talking the other week, I think, about people whose work had passed out of copyright in the year 2021.
Yeah.
And I think we talked about George Bernard Shaw, George Orwell, and people like that. We didn't mention somebody whose work he was proud to say is out of copyright because he's still with us, is the great Tom Lehrer, the great satirical songwriter.
Yes.
The man who gave
us the Vatican rag.
Yeah, the Masochism.
Ave Maria. Gee, it's good to see you.
Yeah, you're with me. You know, plagiarize. Let no one's work plagiarize. All that stuff. So now I've got a number of song titles here, and you have to tell me whether these are the work of the great satirical songwriter Tom Lehrer or stupid songs from less well-known Elvis Presley films. Okay?
That's good.
Are you ready?
Lord, it's so long since I've heard them that I'm not going to remember the Lyra ones, but go on, fire away.
Okay, here we go. Petunia, the Gardener's Daughter. Is that a work of the satirical songwriter Tom Lehrer or an uncelebrated Elvis Presley song from
films? It must be Tom Lehrer because it's too quirky and ironic and clever for an Elvis Presley movie, surely.
Well, there you'd be wrong, Mark, because I win the first round because the Frankie and Johnny film in 1966 starring Elvis Presley, he sings, "I love Petunia the Gardener's Daughter. Oh, how that gal can kiss. Her eyes as blue as bluebells, each cheek a rose to see. How I dance when she plants her two lips on me." Okay, that's the first one.
Pretty all right. One up.
Here we go. "There's no room to rumba in a sports car." Is that one of the celebrated songs of the great Tom Lehrer or an Elvis Presley song?
Presley. I'm sorry, that's Presley.
It is. It's from Fun in Acapulco, 1963.
I remember.
There's no room to rumba in a sports car. You can't move forward or back. There's no room to do what the beat tells you to without throwing your spine out of a rack.
That's genius. That's fantastic. That's a great bit of writing. Yeah.
Okay. How about the Wiener Schnitzel Waltz?
I'm afraid I pretty much know that's Tom Lehrer.
I remember the night I held you so tight as we danced to the Wiener Schnitzel Waltz. I mean, your mum and dad probably had a Tom Lehrer albums, didn't you?
They didn't actually. We had some mates in it. I vividly remember the mid-60s. Thought they were absolutely incredible. Tried to memorize them. There's still footage of him, isn't there? There's still footage of him seeing these things.
Well, he's still with us. He's 92 years old.
Amazing.
Yeah. How about Do the Clam? Do the Clam. Is that Tom Lehrer or Elvis Presley? Do the Clam.
The Clam. It could be either, couldn't it? It could be. There were so many dance vogues going on in the time that Lehrer was writing these. You might well have tried to lampoon the whole concept. So I'm going to say Presley, though, actually.
It is. It's from Girl Happy, 1960.
Yeah.
Do the clam. Grab your barefoot baby by the hand. Turn and tease, hug and squeeze, dig right in and do the clam. poisoning pigeons in the park.
Oh, that's terrible because I remember him singing this. It's Tom Lehrer.
It is Tom Lehrer. When they see us coming, the birdies all try and hide, but they still go for peanuts when coated with cyanide.
Yeah.
Oh, joy. I'm going to leave you with this one. He's your uncle. He's your uncle, not your dad. He's your uncle, not your dad. Is that Tom Lehrer or Elvis Presley?
I think it's a Presley movie. I think
it is. He's your uncle, not your dad. It's from Speedway in 1968.
Fantastic. Well, look, I've got a big pile that I've been chiseling away at, but I'm going to mention one here from an original idea from pod lister Owen Parker. Now, the concept is that pulp songs often have titles that suggest some kind of small scale suburban drama with a soap opera sitcom ring to them, you know, wood chip on the wall, etc. Is it a song by Pulp or is it an episode of Are You Being Served? And these overlap so precisely that actually there was a Pulp album called His and Hers, and that was the title of an Are You Being Served, where the Grace Brothers hire an attractive outside saleswoman, Joanna Lumley, to demonstrate a new unisex line of perfume. So they do actually, you know, literally kind of coincide occasionally. So look, Pulp track or Are You Being Served episode. Oh, what a tangled web.
Oh, it's good. That's good.
Oh, what a tangled web. Is that a song by Pulp?
Oh, it's Are You Being Served?
Both Captain Peacock and Dr. Rumbold's secretary, Miss Hazelwood, are late, and it's rumoured that they're having an affair. It's really brought back. I remember watching these things so vividly. All right, here's another one. Okay, right. Dear Sexy Knickers, Pulp song, Are You Being Served?
I guess a Pulp song.
No, Mr. Lucas tries to salvage his bad day at work by sending a love note to Miss Brahms, asking her to meet him after work. His attempt to deliver the note is thwarted by Captain Peacock. Oh, God. They're good on that. Okay, Help the Aged. Help the Aged. It's Pulp. It's from This Is Hardcore. One time they were just like you, drinking, smoking cigs and sniffing glue. Extraordinary. Okay, Jarvis Cocker or Captain Peacock? The Punch and Judy affair.
Jarvis Cocker.
The gentlemen's and ladies' departments become pariahs when they choose not to take part in a company-wide strike. Acrylic Afternoons.
Pulp.
It is partially, to be fair, Are You Being Served? We never have the word acrylic probably in a title. But yes, it is. Netcoat blows slightly in the breeze. Lemonade light filtering through the trees. Monday morning.
Oh.
Jarvis Cocker or Captain Peacock?
Captain Peacock.
It's Pulp. Is this the light of a new day dawning? No, it's just another Monday morning. Okay. Do you take this man?
That's Are You Being Served?
Yeah, sure. It is. Yeah. Mrs. Slocum becomes engaged to a Greek man called Mr. Metaxas. However, on the morning of the wedding, bad news. The groom is already married. Hoping to help Mrs. Slocum, the staff decide to fake the wedding ceremony there in the store with Mr. Humphreys as her husband-to-be. God, I'd love to see that episode. That's a genius idea, isn't it?
I'm sure you could. Go on YouTube after this. It'll be there. Don't worry.
Absolutely. Very good. All right. Two more. Pencil skirt.
That is pulp.
It is, from different class. Now, you can tell some lies about the good times that you've had, but I've kissed your mother twice and now I'm working on your dad. It's very good. Okay, conduct unbecoming.
Oh, that's are you being served?
Yes, it is indeed. Mr. Humphrey is frequently late for work to reveal that an argument with his mother has forced him to move out. But they're good, aren't they? It's good.
Does Mr. Humphreys live with his mother? I didn't realise that. I forgot think he does. That. Mind you, it's so long since I've been seen Are You Being Served. We were talking about Are You Being Served the other week, weren't we? When we talked about when Dolly Parton was taken off stage by her minder to rescue her from a stage invasion. And she looked like somebody moving a shop window, a mannequin.
That's right.
And that was the name of the character. It struck me afterwards. The guy who played the caretaker or the janitor in Are You Being Served was surely Arthur English. I think he was. And whenever he appeared, he was always have a naked naked mannequin under his arm. Where do you want this? That was a kind of standard line. We forgot to talk about the other week. Did you see the story about... DJ Tiny, who was sacked by Capital Extra.
I did.
For apparently charging £200 to play songs or to keep them on his schedule, and he's been cast into the outer darkness for so doing. It's a long time since anybody's been caught taking pay for play. It strikes me. I can't remember what the last example was. Can you?
Well, no, not really. There was a case in the late 90s, I think. Was it with Limp Bizkit? Do you remember that?
Oh, really?
There was a radio station in Portland called KUFO 101, I think. And they got away with it. They said they'd launched a pay for play thing. So they were trying to be legal about it. They were saying, okay, we will pay us, we will play your record. And they were playing various Limp Bizkit records. And then I think there was a court case whereby they had to declare that they were doing that, which they hadn't kind of made it obvious that this was advertorial. But it must go on all the time, didn't it? And it made me think of Alan...
I don't know. Does it really? I mean, I don't know, because it must be... You know, if you wanted to hype a record, back in the 50s, a relatively simple thing to do, you know, that you
gave Alan Freed $50.
He gave Alan Freed 50% of the B-side.
What a story, Alan Freed, though. Amazing, isn't it? Has anyone ever made a movie out of his life?
Oh, yeah, more than once.
Spent in jail. Lost his show. Blackball.
Finished
up in dying penniless, you know.
Absolutely. And, of course, the interesting thing about Alan Freed was that he's remembered for two things. One is payola, and the other is really loving the music. Really loving the music.
Oh, I thought he invented the expression rock and roll. Wasn't that Alan Freed?
Well, no, I think he was the person who applied it to teenage music. It had been kicking around for ages in music. But, it's what he called what he played, rock and roll.
Yeah.
But he genuinely loved it. But he wasn't above getting his fingers in the till at the same time. And I think that's something that's insufficiently noticed in all these cases. Is that very often, you know, when payola, I think there have been times when payola has been quite significant. If you take particularly the pirate radio era of British radio in the mid-60s, it very often goes along with really good records. And so we were talking the other week, I think, about when we talk about Phil Spector and about how when the Righteous Brothers version of You've Got the Loving Feeling, against all odds, overhauled Cilla Black's version.
Get
to number one, which nobody thought it would, because Cilla Black was the nation's sweetheart and all their records went to number one. And nobody could believe it when Righteous Brothers passed her in the fast lane. And there must have been some jiggery-pokery around that to make that happen. And if you look at, We often say 1965 is the annus mirabilis of the 7-inch 45, you know, the great Rolling Stones records, great Motown records, great, you know, Otis Redding records, Bob Dylan, and so forth. Well, there was hardly any legitimate above-board radio play in Britain at that time. You know, there was the light program. They hardly ever played records. And so if you were not...
With Alan Freed when he played the Little Richard version of Tutti Frutti rather than the Pat Boone one.
Yeah, probably.
So it's possible he was being his palm was being greased to encourage him to do.
Well, it is two things very often go together.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you go back to 1965, you know, you heard most music on Radio Luxembourg, and all Radio Luxembourg shows were sponsored by record companies.
Yeah,
you know, the Teen and 20 Disc Club was EMI or whatever it was, and there was the 15 minutes, half an hour on Saturday night that Tony Hall did was the Atlantic label. Everything was sponsored. And Pirate Radio, 66, 67, I think palms were regularly greased there.
Oh,
but
yeah.
very often in the interest of really good records. And so going back to, you know, our charmed DJ Tiny here on Capital Extra, I say, does it really matter?
It's working in a grand tradition. Well, if you read those 70s rock biographies, you get the impression that to get a record on the radio in America in the 70s did require a certain amount of inducement, didn't it?
Well, I think it was not so much 70s, more the 80s. And, yeah, the 80s and when it came to a head. And I think a lot of that was very much like a kind of protection racket. It was very much like nice restaurant you got here, wouldn't want to see anything unpleasant happen to it.
Yeah.
So it was a bit similar with that with radio stations, that if you didn't pay the people who control the radio play, they'd make sure you didn't get
played.
So given the money wasn't a guarantee that they would make your record a hit, but you can guarantee that if you didn't pay them, your record wouldn't be a hit at all. And it's really interesting. If you go and read about these cases, and I think it was in the late 80s, wasn't it? Very much came to the fore there. There were congressional hearings about this stuff that the American radio market was sewn up by people who worked for the syndicate and were all over the country. And when, I forget which, was it Columbia, I think, said that they were all right, they weren't going to pay it any longer. They weren't going to pay it. They were simply not going to get involved in it. They wanted to be completely above board. Who were the people? Who were the people who were first to knock on the door of a record company saying, you can't stop paying that? Who were the people, Mark? The artists.
They were the people. These records that desperately.
They were the bloody people.
Yeah.
You grease all the palms you need if you can make my record a hit. I don't care at all, you know. So
the way it used to happen at Radio One, it was just the stunts performed by the engineer, by the pluggers. Do you remember that? I mean, that was
above board.
Of course, completely above board, totally above board. But I do remember, I must have been, I suppose it would have been the mid-80s or whatever. I remember a record by ZZ Top coming out called TV Dinners. And some plugger, probably Ferret and Spanner, hired a hydraulic crane at no small expense, and then winched it up to the window of all the radio producers and knocked on their windows and offered them from the outside a tray of fried chicken and coleslaw. And as that kind of thing was just somehow was devised to make them feel warm towards playing this record, which in fact I think they probably did actually. But as
maybe
I said, all above board, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it's all part of the rich pageant of the music business.
It is.
The Word Podcast, prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
So you will have seen, I'm sure, that the great Harry Pinsker, the Beatles accountant, died, and there was a fantastic obituary in the Times. And it struck me, well, fascinating for lots of reasons. One is that the Beatles managed to surround themselves with people very early on that they retained almost throughout their entire career. You know, they had the same manager, they had the same producer, they had pretty much the same engineers, they had the same roadies. The press agent they had most of the time went off and did some time in America, but came back at the end. Fan club managers. It's really interesting. They just identified the right people and kept them. And one of those people was Harry Pinsker. And Harry Pinsker was, I think working with Brian Epstein in the early days, and was in fact he did all of Epstein's stable, didn't he? He was the accountant for Cilla Black and Billy J. Kramer and all that gang. But he started with the Beatles, and he just I felt was really responsible for a lot of things that happened in their lives. You know, he was the guy who told them they were millionaires in 1964. When a million was the equivalent of today's 17 million, he kind of, and the tax man, of course, celebrating the terrible information that he passed on about how much the government take. And then he was the guy who made them account for absolutely everything, all their grocery bills. You know, he was the one who advised them to buy all their houses. And he was the guy who, when faced with a £3 million tax bill in 1967, 68, whatever it was, said, look, why don't you start a company? Why didn't you start Apple? Because you'll otherwise you'll pay that money. You could just lose it through a business enterprise, as they did. Everyone thinks they lost tons of money. Well, they did lose tons of money, but they would have lost that money anyway through tax.
Yeah, the government would have got it,
whatever. But I mean, I thought it was really interesting that a lot of that advice and a lot of their career decisions came through him.
Oh, absolutely, because yeah, they put all their energy into making it, don't they? And then suddenly one day, and in their case, it was quite soon, somebody comes along and says, now, tell you what, chaps, there's now a large sum of money. And you can't just leave this money. You've got to do something with it, you know, because it will, you know, there's two kinds of money problems. There's having no money, and then there's having a lot of money. And, they're both problems.
Having a lot of money, spending too much of it.
And also in the nature of pop music, you'll earn it for a short period of time, and then you probably won't earn it anymore. Yeah. You won't earn it for years or something. So you have to make the most of whatever you've got. No, and he was obviously a person that they listened to. And then they say in their obituary that John Lennon can be heard on some Beatles sessions in Hari Krishna, Hari Pinsker.
That's right. Yes, the Let It Be sessions.
In the background. Yeah,
well, he actually resigned because of Lennon, didn't he? Because, I mean, he worked out that as a director of Apple, I think, he would be sued for indecency.
He could
if they
be.
Were
he
sued for be. Indecency over the Two Virgins car. And he rang up Lennon and said, look, do you really want to put this record out? Was pretty much told to F off. And at that point, resigned. But what an interesting story!
Amazing. I love the little detail in that obituary that when they all bought houses and they were the most famous people on God's earth, suddenly in the mid '60s they all bought houses, and they all wanted phone lines put in. And in those days, it took 6 months to get a phone.
Oh, that's right. Even if you were John Lennon, that's right.
Absolutely, absolutely extraordinary. I can remember it taking unbelievable amounts of time to get phones put in, whereas nowadays it's not the case. Yeah, so Hari Pinsker. And also, you're going back to your first point about this, stick with people. I think it's very often the case that people do, because once you start giving people your financial information, you don't want to mess with that.
No, you don't.
Do you? You don't want to say, all right, I want all the receipts back and everything.
I'm going to start again with somebody else. Yeah.
Doesn't really work out really badly.
Yeah.
It's like most people never change their bank account, do they? It's kind of for the same reason.
Exactly.
You know, you just leave it alone.
Yeah.
So, we were talking about this report about, I think it's an American report, about that seems to imply that all the members of the burgeoning middle class of nowadays like to pretend that they're working class. And I think there was a survey done about this, wasn't there, recently?
Yeah.
And what they found was that all these people who'd kind of been to university and, you know, had kind of professional jobs and had lifestyles and attitudes, which are clearly utterly working class. If you asked them what they were, they would very much very quickly refer back to some struggling antecedent of theirs. You know, it doesn't matter if I've got a company car and, you know, all this kind of stuff. My dad was a miner, or my granddad works in the shipyards or whatever, you know. So that gives me that allows me to pretend that I'm working class. And it struck me it's a syndrome that's absolutely hardwired into pop music, isn't it? You know, that all groups, all members of bands like to pretend that they're slightly rootsier than they are.
Yeah.
It's just a weird thing, isn't it? Because if there's been one thing that's characterized my lifetime, is that everybody has sought to join the middle class, or if they're in the middle class, to stay in the middle class.
Yeah.
Yes. And but nobody talks about that at all. And the term middle class is a term of abuse, whereas, as is the term upper class, whereas the term working class is a term of approval nowadays.
Completely.
If
do you remember the old class system sketch?
To escape it.
Do you remember sketch with Cleese and Ronnie Barker and Roddy Corbett?
Roddy Corbett.
I look down on him and look down on him. I look up to him and look down on him. I have a pain in my neck, or it was. You couldn't do that now. No, it's really interesting. Actually, I was just on a slight tangent. I was watching a television program the other night. I was watching Would I Lie to You, I think. And they introduced Miles Jupp, the comedian. And Miles Jupp was introduced. He's a comedian and actor who's so posh, he was born with a silver spoon in his butler's mouth. It's Miles Jupp. I thought, that's extraordinary, because if you're now posh, no one can avoid mentioning it. You're identified as being posh.
Nobody used to. In the 1960s or 70s, nobody ever talked about it.
No, David Niven was immensely posh. He was just a posh actor, but he wasn't identified as being a posh actor. You wouldn't have to deal with that baggage.
He didn't have to apologise for it.
No, he didn't apologise for it at all. No. There was the actor James Norton was on Graham Norton the other night. The guy was in Happy Valley, and he played a kind of psychopathic rapist and murderer, kind of tattooed, you know. And he said he'd come back on the train after recording one of the episodes in his gear with his fake tattoos on, because he wanted to show his kids. And people started talking to him, and he said, I didn't dare respond. And Norton said, why? He said, because if I do, I just sound like a prick. And you think, this is the guy having to apologise for the fact that he's got a posh accent, you know. Don't you think it's extraordinary? And also, look at those musicians, you know, actually, it didn't matter. You know, the Talking Heads, Chris Frantz's father was a general. Tina Weymouth's father was a vice admiral of the United States Navy. You know, Jim Morrison's dad was a United States rear admiral, wasn't he? You know, James Taylor, you know, posh, you know. Again, nobody had to allude to that. They might have reflected some of that in their songs. They might not, you know. But now, you know, if you're Coldplay or the Maccabees or Lily Allen or whoever, or Mumford, it's part of the package, isn't it?
I suppose so. But it's the idea that they're expected to apologise, I think, is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody should have to apologise for any of that stuff, whether you're privileged or not privileged. I don't think you should have to apologise for your age, whether it's old or young, you know.
Yeah.
It's just who you are. You take as you find. I'll tell you what, funny, talking about class, I'm just reading the new biography of JFK. And here's social mobility, okay?
Yeah.
JFK's great-grandfather, comes from Ireland, 1840s, poor. He's a cooper, a barrel maker in Boston. Works every hour God sends so much that he dies at the age of 35. Works himself to death, but he leaves four kids. One of those kids becomes a saloon keeper, runs for, you know, local council, whatever, so gets into politics. His son also gets into politics and becomes a multimillionaire. His son is president of the United States.
Yeah.
That's four generations.
Incredible.
From absolute poverty.
I know.
To the extent that JFK grew up amidst wealth and privilege, you know, so he's less than
Brian Ferry's the one we often mention, isn't it? Brian Ferry's father, I think, was a miner, wasn't it? Brian Ferry was a kind of...
Retired miner, wasn't he? He used to look after horses.
Yeah,
that worked down the pits, I think.
But kind of working class, and then Brian's class and goes to art school, and then Otis Ferry is the guy who invades the House of Commons to protest on behalf of the fox hunters. You know, that's in three generations. It's amazing.
It's amazing.
I think we've talked about before is Ian Dury. So I think it's fascinating because you have Viv Stanchel from very poor East End, Leytonstone, Walthamstow. I think he grew up in background. And his father convinced him to put on what he called a plummy accent, because he thought he'd do better in life. He put on plummy accent. But Ian Dury, you know, Ian Dury, who came from Harrow Weald and Middlesex, but had to come from Upminster. His mum, Margaret Cuthbert Walker, granddaughter of an Irish landowner. And they moved to Switzerland. I think the Dury's lived in Switzerland for a while. His dad chauffeured a millionaire. So that's an interesting thing, that the really kind of working class guy was Viv Stanchel with the posh accent. And Dury, you know, really played up the working classness. We hadn't come from quite such a humble background as Viv. Interesting.
No, it's very interesting. I've got some I've got some CDs in front of me, which I just cool. Talking to Viv Stanchel, I found this last night, and I was playing it, and I loved it. Songs the Bonzos Taught.
Oh, that's a great record.
Do you know this CD?
Yeah, I do.
If anybody out there is kind of looking for the missing link in the Bonzo Dog story, these are the original versions.
Has he got, I'm going to take a watermelon to my girl tonight?
Well, yes, it does.
Which is great. I brought my love an apple and she let me hold her hand. I brought my love an orange and we danced beneath the band. I bought my love bananas. She let me squeeze her tight. I'm going to bring a watermelon to my girl tonight. Is that right? Oh, it's not such a brilliant.
It's done by the Savoy Havana Band.
That's right.
With Ramon Newton on the vocal.
It's got the noises for the talkies.
It's got Jollity Farm. It's got Ali Baba's Camel. Hunting Tigers Out in India.
India.
My Brother Makes the Noises for the Talkies, A Room with a View, All by Yourself in the Moonlight by the wonderful Whispering Jack Smith. That flies crawled up the window. So that's a glorious thing. Another one, and it is again. This is triggered by conversations we had this week at that Buena Vista Social Club. I dug that out because we were talking about that to Charlie Hickson, who was our guest in Word in Your Attic earlier this week. And that'll be appearing soon. Unless it has done already, I don't think it has done yet. That'll be out there soon.
Fantastic, good. Charlie Hickson is really, really brilliant. He talks about the internal dynamic of how groups work and how comedy writing partnerships work. It's just so revealing and so knowing. Really,
it was very, really interesting. And also, I just found this. I don't know if you know Erin Baudet. Do you know Erin Baudet? She's an American jazzy singer-songwriter. And she's absolutely fantastic and never really made it. I just thought I was playing this record and I thought, I wonder what she's up to at the moment. So I went and looked on her website, and obviously she's like every other musician. Got no gigs, whatever, looking for whatever means of support. And I know we were talking to Lloyd Cole the other few months ago now, and he was doing handwriting his lyrics.
Selling them. Quite rightly.
Presents and so forth. Well, Erin Baudet, going one step further. If you want a songwriting for a particular occasion, she'll do it.
Bespoke songwriting.
Bespoke songwriting.
So your wife's 60th birthday. Yeah.
Or whatever. You know, there she is. Probably erinbaudet.com. You can no doubt find her. And listen, she's fantastic anyway. And so best of luck to her and to any other musician trying to keep body and soul together in these difficult times.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
Okay, any other business? We've been joined by Alex. Hello, Alex, you're right.
Hello, I'm very well. I'm in.
Alex, you've got
a new microphone.
I've replaced the beard with a new mic. That's
it's
my
a whole new you.
It's my coping mechanism. Balance is restored.
The frill is gone.
Yeah. Okay. it was starting to apply weight to my face. I could feel it pressing down. So I decided
You're letting the side down, Alex. I thought we were all going to end up at the end of when this bloody war is over looking like submarine crews who've been underwater for the best part of a year.
The thing is, because I've got quite long hair, I in my mind, I looked like Aragorn from Lord of the Rings. But when I really sat down and thought about it, I just looked like Jim Morrison having let himself go. And I couldn't cope with that disconnect anymore.
15 stone lighter.
You're not as fat as that.
No.
So, Mark, what were you going to say?
Oh, I just wanted to mention, just in terms of just little things that are worth listening to. We'll put a little link to this, but this lovely thing, Pete Perfides, who we've had on this podcast a couple of times, has posted a sweet thing where he's interviewing the Bee Gees in 1997, and he asks them to do an answer phone message for him. I think I sent it to you, and it's just so sweet. And that he wants them to sing, if you want to get a message to Pete, hold on, hold on. And leave your name and number after the beep. Hold on. And they just do it in this absolutely perfect harmony. It's just adorable. It makes you think, what sweet-natured guys they are. And they get it exactly right, and they keep redoing it to make sure they got the words right. And it's just lovely. We'll put a link to it. It's worth hearing. It's fantastic.
Did you notice that the passing of Jim Weatherly, the man who wrote one of my absolute favourite songs, which is Midnight Train to Georgia?
One of my favourites too.
Do you know the story of Midnight Train to Georgia?
Originally Midnight Plane to Houston?
Midnight Plane to Houston, yeah. And the origin of this is Jim Weatherly was a songwriter and a very good football player. Talking of which, it's the Super Bowl today, isn't it? And Bruce Springsteen has done his first ever ad for Jeep, which has been unveiled tonight on the Super Bowl. Anyway, Jim Weatherly was a ball player, and Lee Majors was a ball player. And Lee Majors was married to Farrah Fawcett, as in Farrah Fawcett Majors. And he rang up to speak to Lee Majors and got Farrah. And she said, well, tonight I'm going to take a midnight plane to Houston to go and see family. And he thought, that's a good idea for a song. So he wrote a song called Midnight Plane to Houston, Midnight Train to Houston, I think. And then he put it out there. And the first producer who came back said, I want to record this, but I want to use Sissy Houston, who's, you know, Whitney Houston's mother. And I can't have it Midnight Train to Houston if it's done by Sissy Houston. Would you mind if I changed it to Georgia? Yeah, fine. Okay.
He said, look, keep the rest of the song exactly as it is. Absolutely fine. Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
It's absolutely brilliant. God, I love that
record. I love that song. When we were in college, we were obsessed with that record, and we used to sing it and take the parts of either Gladys Knight or the Pips. And it's one of those rare records where the backing vocal is as integral as the vocal itself. The whole song is an integral. There aren't many examples of that. Just a Gigolo, possibly by Louis Prima, might be another one, actually. But ones where it's unhelped by the Beatles, actually, is possibly another. But it's one of those songs where it's all about the interplay between the two of them. It's fantastic.
And I also... Yes. I also love the idea that it's about failure, that it's a song about, I haven't made it, L.A. proved too much for the man.
That's right.
So he's going back to find a distant place in time or whatever. You know, it's like, But it's like, do you know the way to San Jose? Same thing, you know what I mean? Somebody leaving Hollywood, having tried to make it.
Yeah.
It's just too brutal. They're going back to the rest of America. So they're wonderful records. Go on.
Whenever I hear a song title like that, I can't help but think about how you can't do that with British place names like Midnight Train to Cardiff or Runcorn. I really want to find a way to make that to Midnight Train to Redditch.
Do you think it's also because the distances in Britain are just not far enough?
It's just, everywhere is just an hour away, isn't it?
Even Aberdeen is, you know, not that far away, really.
No, it's got to be hundreds of miles of scenic landscape, you know. We don't have any romance about our place names at all. You think of all the ones in America, the geography, people's obsession with place names, and they all sound fabulous to us, but the reverse is not true.
But also, Americans regularly move, it seems to me. They live in San Francisco, and then they just uproot, and they go and live in Houston. And then they might go to live in New York. I don't think people do that in Britain. They tend to come from home, very often go to London, and then never really go back or whatever. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I don't feel people are born in Cambridge and then go to Cardiff. I don't know. I may be completely wrong.
No, that's true.
I never feel that at all. Anyway, what else? Elvis Costello's very touching obituary for his mother.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's so sweet.
Immensely detailed. Extraordinary. It's like a novel, isn't it? It's
Well, it struck me. Elvis was an only child. It struck me that he couldn't have had a more colourful and vivid musical education. Yeah. You know, his dad was in the covers band, bringing home records before they'd even really been released, so he had that access to music. And his mum and dad met, I think, in she got a sales job in Draper's Music Shop, and then she got a job in the jazz department of another record shop, and that's where she met his dad. And they ran jazz nights called Bop City. Just so brilliant, I think.
He was the child of record nerds, wasn't he?
Completely, really? Record nerds and live performance nerds. There's a bit in his autobiography where he talks about going to the Hammersmith Palais as a kid where his dad's band was playing, and how he said he had a cocktail of spilt beer, stale tobacco, and stifled tears of jilted girls. I thought that really meant that you're really understanding the whole business of live venues there. Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. It's really, really touching, I think.
Yeah, very definitely, very definitely. So what else, what's going on, Alex, in the world of Word in Your Ear? Anything we should tell people about?
We have
the
some
quiz
new
goes from strength to strength. Go on.
Okay, so I'd like to extend a hearty welcome to Stuart McAllister.
I said I must do this in the next week. I'm actually going to see if I can buy a bosun's whistle. Okay, so
that's what we need. So we just
pipe people aboard. Okay, and I think I know the place where I can get a bosun's whistle
or a duck quack. It just needs to be a noise that accompanies the idea of somebody arriving, doesn't it?
Yeah. Go on.
Okay, Mark Stevens.
Good man.
Welcome, Mark.
Dougie Jones.
Of course.
And annual patrons, of course, you get a 15% discount on your subscription if you subscribe annually. Tanya Correa and
hello, Tanya.
John Hilton.
Right, well, nice to have them all on board. We'll be marking more people's birthdays in the next week, won't we, I think, Alex?
I think we've got three or four this week.
They've
all been a lot of fun to do.
They've all been terribly entertaining.
Incredibly good. We did Keith Adsley the other day. It was terrific. Really, really fun.
Very good.
Really enjoyed it.
And so the Word in Your Attics continue. You know, over the last week, we've had Jonathan Coe over the last week. We did Charlie Hickson last week.
It was superb.
And we got Mid-Year coming up
in
the next week and more. So, you know, usual drill, if you want to make sure you get all of this and you get it in full and you get it in pictures where applicable and you get it first and you don't miss anything, and also get the warm glow of feeling that you're somehow, you know, putting coal on the fire here, not just sitting around borrowing a bit of heat. You know, there's only one way to do that, and that's to draw near by being a Patreon supporter. And you go to patreon.com/wordinyourear, you find the various different ways of doing that. Anything further to add, Alex, Mark? No?
I think that's it.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.